Welcome to Sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto. Each week, we share a recording of the Sunday sermon, offering theologically progressive, social justice-oriented reflections grounded in Scripture and what's happening in our lives and in the world. Most weeks, the sermon is preached by our pastor, the Reverend Tom Harris, and from time to time, we're joined by guest preachers. In this sermon from May 17, 2026, Reverend Harris offers a path to ending domination and war. These are lofty goals, and he begins by suggesting that we will be disappointed by the solution. The solution he offers is that people follow the Ten Commandments. He then makes the case that in the Bible, the Ten Commandments are given as an alternative to systems of domination such as Pharaoh's enslavement of the Hebrew people. And the work of following them is not about just doing the minimum, but examining the deeper principles underlying each one. If we can't do that ourselves, can we really expect others to do it?
So last Sunday, I said that war is a symptom of an illness that afflicts humanity. And that illness is our hierarchical nature. The illness is our will to dominate over others and our willingness to be dominated. And I said that today I would suggest how we can end hierarchy and thus end war. And I suspected that when you heard the solution, you would be disappointed. So prepare to be disappointed. We can end hierarchy by following the Ten Commandments. Now, I hope I prepared you enough that that was not too much of a letdown, but let me try to make the case for this solution. First, let me say I don't love the word commandments, but for the sake of familiarity, let's call them commandments. I'm going to do a summer sermon series on the Ten Commandments, and we're not going to call them that for the series, and I'll explain that when we get there. But for today, we'll call them commandments. Now let me address a few objections that I imagine you might have to this proposed solution to ending war. One objection to this solution might be that yes, of course we follow the Ten Commandments. We are good people. The problem is getting other people to do it. But if we're honest, do we really follow the Ten Commandments? I think often when people say they follow the Ten Commandments, what they're really meaning is I don't murder people. But you know there's nine others that you're supposed to follow. And can we really say that we never lie, never covet, never work on the Sabbath, never worship other gods or bow down to idols? So I agree, it's true that it will be difficult to get everyone to follow the Ten Commandments. I never said it would be easy, but it will be especially difficult when we are not even doing it ourselves. Another objection is that the Ten Commandments are Judeo-Christian teachings and not universal. So how can we expect everyone in the world to follow them? And yes, I agree. And I think there are some universal ethical principles for human behavior that if we all followed them would transform the world. And the Ten Commandments are not a perfect articulation of those universal principles. No tradition, including our own, perfectly articulates those universal ethical principles, whatever they may be. It may be impossible to say them perfectly for all times and places and cultures. But the Ten Commandments are, for our tradition, one imperfect expression of those yet to be perfectly expressed ethical principles. Now, another objection to this solution might be that we are Christians. So we know that we can't follow the law perfectly, and so therefore we rely on the grace of God for our salvation. Why, Pastor Tom, are you talking about Ten Commandments? This is not a synagogue. Oh, but how quickly we forget that Jesus, you know, our guy, in his Sermon on the Mount, not only tells us to follow the Ten Commandments, as we just heard, but teaches that we need to do more than the legal minimum. For instance, he says, you have heard that it was said, do not murder. But I say to you, if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. If you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you'll be liable to the fires of hell. Yeah, we forget about that side of Jesus, don't we? And he does the same thing after that with two more commandments, indicating that we can probably apply the same principle of going beyond the legal minimum to all 10 of them. So if we're going to follow the teachings of Jesus, living according to the 10 commandments is not about avoiding the worst behaviors. It's about attempting to live according to our very highest values. And let's not forget, as we think about this, another teaching that Jesus offered. He said, why do you try to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye when you have a log in your own eye? First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. So following the Ten Commandments is really all about self-examination. We can't even start to hope that others will follow them unless we are dedicated to ourselves doing so. Now I know this is the most disappointing anti-war sermon you've ever heard. I was supposed to be making us all feel really good and self-righteous about how right we are to be against war and how wrong our government is to be leading us into wars. What is this tangent about the Ten Commandments? What we really want you to do, Pastor Tom, is tell us that Pete Hegseth is a jerk. And I'll give you that. Pete Hegseth is a jerk. But I also want you to understand this is not a tangent. I believe what I'm saying is profoundly biblical, because in the Bible, the commandments are given to the Hebrew people not as an individual moral code, but as a collective antidote to hierarchy and empire. They are given to the Hebrew people in Exodus 20, shortly after they have been liberated by God from slavery. They are given as the alternative to living under systems of domination. So let's recap that story. The Hebrew people were experiencing one of the most extreme forms of hierarchy and domination. They were enslaved by Pharaoh. They were suffering so much from Pharaoh's tyranny that they cried out to God. And God heard their cry and sent Moses as an emissary to tell Pharaoh to release the people from slavery. Pharaoh refused. And then God basically went to war against Pharaoh. God started to physically dominate Pharaoh through the 10 plagues, and by extension, God physically was dominating the Egyptian people. Now, you might ask in this anti-war, anti-hierarchy, anti-domination sermon, how can God be described as one who violently dominates a tyrant and his people? And it's a good question. I think one answer is that the more the illness of domination progresses within a society, the more dominating each of us become, and the more it becomes the norm, the more painful the treatment for that illness will be. So the story of the plagues is a story of God's treatment for a calcified, diseased system of domination that had affected the whole society, and that treatment was necessarily painful. Because there is no way to move in a soft, easy move from a system of domination to a system of equality. Or to put that another way, if we believe God will ultimately tear down all hierarchies and empires, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Now we might say, but the Egyptian people, the regular people, were innocent. But were they? Weren't they benefiting from the slavery of the Hebrew people among them? Weren't they enriching themselves at the expense of that enslaved labor? Are we in this room entirely innocent of the crimes of the American empire today? If God were to tear down the American empire, how would we avoid the suffering? So then back to the story, God sends the 10 plagues. Interestingly, since all 10 plagues are natural phenomena, this could be easily described as nature rising up to address the inequalities and injustices of Egyptian society. And that's important too for us, because if we look at what we're doing to nature today, it does seem that nature is starting to rise up herself in our day and age. Okay, so finally Pharaoh relents and lets the people go. But as they leave, Pharaoh changes his mind and sends his armies to recapture them. But just as the Hebrew people seem destined to be recaptured at the shores of the Red Sea, God parts the sea The people cross on dry land. When Pharaoh's armies follow, God closes in the sea behind them, and Pharaoh's armies are drowned. Afterward, we are told that Moses' sister Miriam sings what may be one of the oldest preserved pieces of oral tradition in the Bible. It's a song. And scholars think this may be the oldest song that's in the entire Bible. She says, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea." So the oldest text in the Bible is a celebration of God defeating an oppressive military. Or just to make that plain, we end this story of God liberating the Hebrew people from slavery with God destroying the empire's war machine. So then we get a few chapters of God providing miraculously for the people as they travel to Mount Sinai. They arrive at Mount Sinai, Moses ascends the mountain and receives the Ten Commandments as well as the rest of the Torah, but for our purposes, we can just talk about the commandments. In those commandments, we get the following. First, God's self-identification as above all else, the one who liberates people from domination and tyranny. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." That's how the Ten Commandments begin. God is a liberator. Then we get three commandments about how people should relate to God. And those three are really important because they are all about the way that if we are going to be free of domination, God needs to take the place of Pharaoh. God needs to take the place of empire. At the same time, they're very clear that this God can't be put in a box, can't be defined, can't be made into an idol, can't be named. And so in the place of Pharaoh, we are given what? Mystery, spirit, community, a list of ethical principles on how we treat each other. The next seven are two positive commandments: honor the Sabbath and honor your parents, and then five prohibitions against different kinds of harm. So in other words, God gives the people this law related to how they're to have reverence for God and reverence for each other as the alternative to hierarchies and domination. Thus, the biblical answer to how do we end war is to follow the Ten Commandments. And if the whole world isn't doing it, we start with ourselves, with our families and our community, and we build up from there. Now, let's be clear. The answer is not to post the Ten Commandments on the classroom of every place in America, every school in America. The answer is not to make monuments of the Ten Commandments for every public square. The way to end war is that we follow the Ten Commandments. Now, I know you still really need me to say some things about how terrible war is. So I'm going to give you that. War is really terrible. And every war plants the seed for the next war. Violence only begets more violence, or in the words of Jesus, those who live by the sword die by the sword. By fighting wars, we are not ever really solving anything. Maybe we're for a brief moment solving a problem that one group has if they win, but we're just then creating more problems for our children and our grandchildren. Violence begets more violence. And if we're faced with a situation where we feel that war or fighting is the only solution, for example, if our homeland is being invaded, we still need to understand in our deliberations that killing another human being is a moral failure. It is the ultimate moral failure. It's like I said, the original sin of humanity, according to the story of Cain and Abel. And so war is killing thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people. So war is the proposal that we can solve our problems with a million moral failures. And in most cases, if we are faced with the choice of whether to support a war or fight in a war, we've gotten to that decision point because of a million moral failures that happened before us. That's what war is. We are in a situation that is the result of a million failures, and we decide the only way to get out of it is to fail a million more times. Or perhaps to say that solution in the terms of an old adage, the first step to getting out of a hole is to stop digging. So how do we stop digging into the hole of violence? We follow the Ten Commandments. We attempt in the sphere where we have the most influence, which is first our own souls and our families and our communities. We attempt to follow these principles, not just in a perfunctory way, but deeply. We are seeking to align ourselves with these never perfectly stated universal ethical principles that the Ten Commandments approximate. Now, before I turn toward my closing, I want to say something about the summer sermon series that I mentioned on the Ten Commandments so that you aren't worrying about it for the next 2 weeks. In reflecting on the Ten Commandments for today, we are going to have to do some interpretation. We're going to have to do some updating even. I said they're not perfect. For instance, in the 10th commandment, it says we should not covet our neighbor's wife or donkey, essentially putting those two things in the same category. And never saying, by the way, that we should not covet our neighbor's husband, which I think lets gay men and asexual people off the hook, because coveting another person's wife is the only thing that's technically prohibited. You can do the math on that, I don't know. And of course, in interpreting and updating those commandments, we would be doing exactly what Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount. He was reinterpreting the commandments for his time. He called us to take a deeper look beyond the legalistic words, not just what do they say, but what do they mean. So be assured, we are going to discuss them in ways that are applicable for our time. Now, just to tie this disappointing sermon back to the crux of what I think is the disappointment, I believe the crux of the disappointment with the solution offered in this sermon is that what we really want is a political solution to war, not a personal one. We don't want to change ourselves, we want to change other people. But I think on this point, we can learn from the Black church historically. In his new book, Young King, Dr. Lerone Martin of Stanford, who will be here to share about the book on June 10th at 7:30, he writes about Martin Luther King as a boy and the church that he attended. That's where it kind of starts out with this church, Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where King's father was the pastor. Lerone Martin writes this: Black churches were the first autonomous institution in African American life. They were political, social, cultural and spiritual centers organizing for freedom and broader societal changes, such as access to voting, fair wages, housing, and public accommodations. Right? That's what we wanted in this sermon. Politics, good politics. Give us some good anti-war policy, Pastor Tom. But Lerone Martin then continues, Black religious leaders also understood that, quote, politics went beyond formal participation in explicitly political activities, but included everyday practices that enabled Black folk to live as human beings amid the daily dehumanization of Jim Crow. Beyond politics, to include everyday practices that enabled Black folks to live as human beings amid the daily dehumanization of Jim Crow. Practicing the Ten Commandments is an everyday practice that makes us human amidst the daily dehumanization of the empire. Now, many of us in this room are people with considerable wealth or power or privilege, and over the past couple of years, for the first time maybe in our lives, we have been feeling powerless over the political process. We currently have one of the most unpopular presidents in history bombing innocent people around the world at will, and we feel powerless to stop it. We have a government that is working hard to establish minority rule on a permanent basis, and we feel powerless to stop it. And of course, we need to keep engaging in the explicit political activities, organizing, letter writing, canvassing, boycotts, strikes, and voting, etc. But don't give that up. But we need to learn from oppressed people throughout history, from the Hebrews to the present day, how to wield power when we no longer have access to the halls of power. They can teach us that politics is more than voting, more than organizing, and more than good legislative policy. Politics is how we live every day as human beings in a world that tries to dehumanize us. Or to say that the other way, finding our true humanity and living our true humanity is an overtly, profoundly political act. Practicing reverence for God and for all people is the most powerful thing that we can do every day. And the Ten Commandments teach us that reverence. So getting serious about practicing them is the antidote to domination. It is resistance to empire. It is the path to ending war. And most importantly, it is an act of reclaiming our humanity. Amen.
Thanks for listening to sermons from First Presbyterian Church, Palo Alto, located at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, California. If you'd like to worship with us, we gather Sundays at 10 a.m., both in person and online. And you can find more information about our congregation, worship, and ministries at fpcpaloalto.org. We hope to see you soon.